Polar Futures is an investable universe podcast about investment issues in eight countries of the far north. The future of energy, mining, infrastructure, shipping, trade, telecom, and even space tech will be put to the test in this once remote region. Can we do better for Earth in the future by doing these things right in the Arctic? We'll get into it on Polar Futures. I recently spoke with Greenland's Foreign Minister, Pelle Broberg, on his country's efforts to secure greater independence from Denmark, particularly as Arctic development accelerates. And to that end, he was very excited about a book that had just been released in Denmark that he believes could really change the whole conversation around Greenland's relationship with Denmark. My guest on this episode is Anna Kristina Hermann, the Danish journalist who wrote that book. It's called Imperiets Børn, or Children of the Empire, on Denmark's attempts to absorb the world's largest island, Greenland, in the post-World War II era, essentially colonizing it while denying that it was, in fact, being colonized. What happened, what it was like for Greenland, and how that legacy is still in evidence in Greenland and in Danish-Greenlandic relations. Anna Kristina Hermann is a PhD journalist and Fulbright scholar. Imperiets Børn was written with support from the Kim Wall Memorial Fund and the Carlsberg Foundation in Denmark. Anna Kristina Hermann, thank you for speaking with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
This is going to be such an interesting and provocative conversation, I think. You refer to Greenland in this book as a camouflaged colony. What does that mean?
Well, as you said in your intro, Denmark ultimately colonized Greenland while denying that Greenland was a colony. Back in 1945, when the UN was established, the UN Charter basically outlawed international colonialism, and the member states that had colonies, including Denmark, had to they pledged to work to give their colonies home rule, self-rule, independence of some sort. But Denmark didn't want to give up Greenland, so instead the Danish government worked to assimilate Greenlanders in order to make the argument in the UN that Greenland was in fact a natural integral part of Denmark. And this is what I call a camouflaged colony, because then with the change of the Danish constitution in 1953, Greenland was annexed, you could say, legally by Denmark, and it became it was no longer a colony, but a county, so to speak, in Denmark. And what the Danes said in the UN was that there was no big cultural or ethnic differences between Greenland and Denmark. But that was, first of all, not true, and second of all, the similarities that were there between the two peoples were due to the vast assimilation efforts by the Danish government in the early 1950s.
So how unique is Greenland's status in that regard? You mentioned that there is this decolonization, or sort of a rejection of colonization efforts at the highest levels of global governance happening after World War II in the United Nations. And yet, look what happened in Greenland. I mean, is there another territory in the modern era that has experienced something similar?
Well, what happened in the late 40s and early 50s was that the colonial countries, there were eight colonies, member states in the UN, and they argued that, you know, there were different paths to self-rule, and that independence, full autonomy was not the only way to get self-rule in the sense that the UN Charter used that word. And so there was an ongoing debate and negotiation over that term. What did self-rule really mean? Mm-hmm. And over the years, that term was expanded. So in effect, there were three paths to self-rule. First, there was the option for a colony to get full autonomy. The second option was to get some kind of home rule where you were in association with another state. And we saw that with, for instance, Puerto Rico and the relationship that Puerto Rico has with, still has with the USA. And then the third option that Denmark really worked hard to get accepted was this idea that you could incorporate the colony into being a normal part of the metropolitan state. Mm-hmm. So Greenland was the first state to be, or the first colony to be absorbed in this way in the mm-hmm. in the so-called mother country. But other former colonies got self-rule in different ways in these years, and Puerto Rico is an example of that.
In the World War II era, Greenland wasn't the only holding, let's say, that Denmark had. They had Iceland and they had the Faroe Islands, which both, Iceland certainly broke away more decisively from Denmark. Why was it so hard for Denmark to relinquish what you might call ownership of Greenland after World War II? Like, why couldn't they just let it go?
Well, that's a good question. I think it had a lot to do with what you mentioned happening with the Faroe Island and Iceland. Now, you have to, from the Danish point of view, Denmark had been territorially much bigger. Mm-hmm. And over the years, 1864 is still a central year in Danish history where we lost a large part of our territory to the Germans, and that became a pivotal moment. And I think then up, in the 20th century, there was the sale of the Virgin Islands to the Americans, the three Virgin Islands. Mm-hmm. And then during the occupation of Denmark, during World War II, Iceland chose to leave the Union with Denmark. Mm-hmm. And become a republic. And then just after the war, the Faroe Island population voted in favor of independence as well, something that the Danish government then denied them and negotiated a form of home rule that was expansive, but not quite autonomy for the islands. But mm-hmm. in any case, you have this sense in the Danish government at this point that the territory is shrinking and shrinking. And the prime minister at the time, the social democrat Hans Hedtoft, stated in some of the documents I've looked at in the archives that, he didn't want to be in charge of a Denmark that grew smaller and smaller. Oh. It would be dishonorable somehow. Mm-hmm. So there was definitely this idea that, that the borders of Denmark were threatened, and you wanted to be a bigger country than Denmark itself is. So that was really a big sort of nationalist inclination at the time. But there were, of course, also other concerns. Greenland is an important landmass in terms of security politics. And, mm-hmm. And then there were the natural resources in Greenland that already at this time was something that the Danish government knew about and was very interested in, mm-hmm. and speculated that basically finding minerals in Greenland would change the Danish economy for the better. Mm-hmm. So there were a host of different concerns for the Danish government that made it reluctant to really, give Greenland the autonomy that the UN was pressing for.
Yeah. So on that note, move on to the central thesis of your book, which is an explosive assertion to make that the Danish government actually withheld important information from the people of Greenland and misled the UN General Assembly on Greenland's legal status. Can you explain how exactly this misleading took place? Because that's that brings things to another level.
Yeah, so some of the misleading statements that Denmark gave in the UN included the statement that there were no longer any Inuit in Greenland, that the people there were a mix of Scandinavian blood and Inuit, or in the terms back then, Eskimo blood. Mm-hmm. So Denmark basically claimed that it was not there were no ethnic differences between Denmark and Greenland, mm-hmm. which was not true. The other thing, you know, in Denmark, we had a referendum in 1953 to approve the new constitution that absorbed Greenland into Denmark, but the Greenlandic population didn't get the chance to vote on this. And of course, the other UN member countries asked about this. Why was there no referendum in Greenland to decide this? And the Danish answer was, you know, oh, but everyone in Greenland wanted this development, and it would have been it would have been offensive to not listen to what they wanted and ask for a referendum. It was kind of a bizarre argument. So there were a lot of claims like this. Basically, also another important point that the Danish delegation made in the UN was that the initiative to the integration had come from the Greenlanders themselves, which is not the case. It's very evident when you look at the documents in the different archives here in Denmark that it was the Prime Minister Hans Hedtoft who brought the question to the Greenlanders and pressed for them to decide also very quickly. That's another thing that was withheld from the UN, namely that the Greenlanders had one day to decide whether they wanted the integration. They didn't get other, there weren't no other options proposed. So it was, remain a colony or get integrated into Denmark. And all of this, wasn't put to the UN. In fact, there was a transcript of a meeting in Greenland where the proposal from the Danish government had been presented. And it was, it was just an excerpt of the meeting, and all the critical voices of the Greenlandic politicians had been redacted. So it was not part of the documents that the UN saw. So that's the misleading or the withholding of information to the UN. And then there is the lack of information that the Danish government gave to the Greenlanders. Mm-hmm. They were not told that they actually had three options, that they also had the option of full independence or home rule. And, they were not included in the process. The colonies at this point in time didn't have their own delegations in the UN. So Greenlanders were completely dependent on the Danish authorities to give them the information of what was going on politically at the UN.
So does Greenland at this stage, anno 2021, have any legal recourse against Denmark given this information? Does that change their current options? I mean, I know there's been Home Rule Act passed in the late 70s. There's been an update to that legislation passed in 2009. Does the revelation of what happened just after World War II change Greenland's options today?
No. What I think the Greenlandic government is considering is whether to ask for an apology for the way things went down, because essentially with the self-rule law from 2009, you could say that Greenland can Greenland can gain independence at any point in time that the Greenlanders want, as long as they accept no longer getting any, subsidies from Denmark financially. Mm-hmm. But so from with the law from 2009, the Greenlanders can secede. But I think it's more the question of, you know, the history between 53 and 2009, where there was oppression of the Greenlandic culture and language, which, you know, was only an effect of the fact that Greenland was absorbed into Denmark. It was unnecessary, and it was very harsh, and it had huge social huge social impact on the population. Yeah. So I think, you know, the recourse from the Greenlandic government might be more along those lines of, you know, a critique of what happened in the past, and not so much in terms of the legal status of Greenland today, is what I think. But yeah. But I'm not a legal scholar, so but this is that's what I think is most accurate.
So you described this process to try to sort of absorb or integrate the people of Greenland as a fordanskningsprocess, an, you know, effort to make them more Danish. And I think that maybe listeners in North America may hear that and think about some of the stories that are going on the headlines with, for example, Indigenous schools in Canada. There's a major national reckoning going on there. In the United States, there have been, has at various points in recent history had, you know, been confronted with relations vis-a-vis Native Americans. Can you talk about what the cultural fordanskningsprocess that Denmark undertook in Greenland, how did that manifest, and what was the impact on Greenlanders that you spoke with for this book?
Yeah, it's not that different from the idea of the residential schools that we know from Canada. Of course, I don't want to make the comparison too large, since, you know, there is no question that it was much worse what happened in Canada, and with the death of so many children, it's a terrible, terrible case. Mm-hmm. But the idea, I think, was similar in Greenland. The idea from the Danish government side and the Danish administration was that Greenlandic culture was inferior, and Greenlandic the Inuit language was inferior. And basically, the idea was to educate Greenlanders to be European. Mm-hmm. And the methods for doing so was pretty harsh. You know, in the 50s, the Danish government introduced about 8 new laws for Greenland that would completely change the Greenlandic society, which at this point was still, you know, the monetary economy was quite limited. A lot of families lived from what they could catch, and maybe they bought a bit of sugar or coffee or so in the store, but they were mm-hmm. basically
subsistence level.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. They would live from what they caught in nature, and, you know, they were sealers mm-hmm. and fishermen. But the Danish government then introduced all these laws to very rapidly change this traditional society into a modern European society. They wanted the Greenlandic fishing industry to take hold and become like a new source of income. So the government built a new fishing industry and forcefully closed several smaller settlements and villages in order to concentrate the population in the bigger cities. They actually wanted to concentrate the whole population in only 4 cities mm-hmm. To have a fishing industry. So, of course, some of the social consequences were that people were evicted from their homes. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the government, the Danish government introduced a new school system in which the, you know, talented kids would be taught in Danish. And this, again, was an effect of the belief that the Inuit language was inferior and that you couldn't produce knowledge or thought in Inuit native language. So the government wanted the kids to speak Danish and they wanted them to learn very quickly. And in order to get this change through over just a few years, they forced children to go to Denmark to learn Danish. And it started, in fact, with a so-called experiment with 22 kids that were sent to Denmark to be, they were going to be front runners when they came back home, mm-hmm. but they were abducted by their families and sent to Denmark and assimilated culturally and linguistically. And then they were supposed to come back and be the front runners in the new Greenlandic schools. But for a multitude of reasons, the experiment completely failed. And mm-hmm. some kids were adopted by foster parents in Denmark, and the rest, 16 kids, would live the rest of their childhood at an orphanage in the capital, Nuuk. Mm-hmm. And you know, they never knew why they didn't return to their families. Mm-hmm. That only came out, you know, decades later. But also lots of children after this this experiment was carried out were sent to Denmark to stay for 1 year with the foster family. And for some kids that was fine and they enjoyed the stay and had good relationships with their foster families. But for a lot of people and for people that I've interviewed, it was, you know, very traumatic experience to be maybe 12 years old and sent 2,000 kilometers south to a country you've never seen before. You don't speak the language and you don't have any contact with your parents for a year. You know, it's self-evident that that can be quite impactful and harmful to children.
Yeah.
So these are, you know, two examples of the kind of social consequences that this rapid assimilation process had on the Greenlandic people.
So to what extent do you think this impulse to, let's say, re-educate or remake Greenlanders into a Danish image had to do with Denmark's larger transition to a socialist welfare state, or what you would consider like what we in the U.S. observe as, you know, the Scandinavian social welfare model? There was this kind of, it would seem from the outside perspective that there was this kind of larger re-education of society going on after World War II. And it seems plausible that some part of what was going on in Greenland might have been viewed within that larger context, that there was a bigger social experiment taking part and Greenland was one part of that. Is that possible?
It has that has certainly been like the official narrative has been that this was, you know, done with the best of intentions. The intentions were to help the Greenlanders and, mm-hmm. you know, modernize them, give them a better way of living. And perhaps that has been the case, you know, for individuals involved. But if you look at the documents in, you know, the governmental archives, it's plain to see that the main motivation for the Danish government was to hold on to Greenland. Like the main motivation to start all these reforms, social reforms in Greenland, were motivated by the pressure from the UN to decolonize. So, of course, you know, I'm not denying that there was also an aspect of wanting to extend the welfare state to the Greenlandic people. And I think there has been individuals involved that have done great work and you know, with the right motives. But I, you know, the point in my book is that if you look at, you know, the motivation of the government, it was not to help the Greenlanders to have a better life. That was not the main motivation. Mm-hmm. The main motivation was to be able to tell the UN, Greenland is a natural part of Denmark. It's not a colony. It's in fact, you know, just another county of Denmark.
So yeah, apropos of that, you know, just another county of Denmark, can you maybe describe for our listeners what happened with labor relations in Greenland after the 1950s? What was the job market like for Greenlanders as opposed to Danes who maybe took the opportunity to relocate to Greenland?
That was the irony of it, because the idea was, as I said, Greenlanders were evicted in many cases from their settlements and were told you have to work in a fishing factory now instead of being a sealer. But at the same time, a lot of Danish workers, engineers, specialists came to Greenland to help build this new modern society. They had they were not taxed. They had a lot of, you know, economic incentives to go and work there. And in effect, you saw unemployment growing in the cities that the Danes had moved the Greenlandic population into. And, you know, by many historians, it's been described as the Greenlanders really standing on the sideline, seeing how Danish workers would come up and make a fortune rebuilding Greenland. And many of the Danish workers would also start new companies and really, you know, they basically became a new class. There were new class divisions that wasn't common in Greenland at that time. Suddenly you had these Danish merchants and you had a poor working class of Greenlanders. Mm-hmm. And of course, this has also been something that has really put a rift in the relationship between Greenlanders and Danes. Mm-hmm.
What is the standard of living like in today's Greenland compared to, if you're going to compare to Denmark or other Nordic regions like Iceland, for example? What is the standard of living like for ordinary Greenlanders today?
In many ways, it's comparable to Denmark, but the welfare system is impacted by the distance between, by the vast space that a very small population occupies. So, you know, when I lived in Greenland more than 10 years ago, there were no dentists there because you have a population of just under 60,000 on the whole island, in very small cities, even the capital. So of course, it's hard to uphold a welfare system comparable to the Danish. Mm-hmm. The standard of living is lower. And of course, you also have the quote-unquote problem of having goods imported. It's quite expensive to buy vegetables, etc. in Greenland. If you go to the very north, to Thule, you have boats coming with goods twice a year in the summer when there's still, you know, before the sea ice closes the waterway. Mm-hmm. And I was there in the summer it was in June 2018, and you know, the store was empty. There was nothing left to buy there. So yeah, of course, it's in certain ways, it's not really comparable to the standard of living in Denmark.
So their goods all have to be imported. So there's a higher cost of goods for Greenlandic people. And do they have a lower per capita income? So they have lower income paying for those more expensive goods.
I believe so. And some of the goods are subsidized. I don't know the exact numbers, but I believe that the average income for sure in Greenland is lower.
So what is preventing Greenland from pursuing greater political and economic self-determination today?
I think in large part, it has to do with economy. As I said, you know, with the act from 2009, Greenland can secede anytime. Mm-hmm. But if the Greenlanders choose to do so, the subsidies from Denmark will also terminate. And mm-hmm. And I don't think that the Greenlandic economy at this point is sustainable. So to my knowledge, what the Greenland government is trying to look into and what governments in the past the decades have been looking into is like, how can Greenland evolve a sustainable economy? And you had a, there was an election this spring in Greenland.
Yes.
That where the main topic was whether or not to source different, you know, minerals, including uranium, from a mine in Greenland. And some of the population was very strongly against that, and that side of the population won the election. But, you know, from the other point of view, the argument was that sourcing these minerals, however, you know, polluting or dangerous to the environment, might, you know, be the path to independence. So, you know, of course, that's a very tough question when you have a population that's very devoted to nature and doesn't want to pollute or contribute to climate change or anything like that. And then on the other hand, you're looking for a path, an economical path to independence. That those are the kind of dilemmas that the population faces.
Right. Well, you described the you mentioned the controversy over the mining project to mine strategic minerals, some rare earth metals that involve some uranium. You know, in previous decades, it was about the possible presence of offshore oil and gas. Right? Does Greenland have?
Correct.
Would you characterize this as like a resource curse that's made it harder for Greenland than maybe other territories to break definitively from Denmark?
Well, in the way that I understand it, it's not quite the way what's happening in Greenland, because in Greenland, you know, you mentioned also the offshore oil and the rare earth minerals, and to a large extent, these resources haven't been collected yet. You know, they haven't been sourced or mined or drilled. So in fact, it's. I think the situation is a bit different because there is a promise of a lot of riches in the underground, but thus far it's been too risky, or there hasn't been the political will to source them, because there is also a large concern for the environment and for the animal life, you know, marine life.
Aside from just the mineral resources or the natural resources that can be extracted, there is also the emergence of new shipping routes in the Arctic. You mentioned that this is a tough question, obviously, but do you think this is an opportunity for Greenland, or does this pose another threat of foreign exploitation? Because it would be terrible for Greenland, you know, to a greater measure of independence from Denmark, only to become beholden to another country with ambitions in the Arctic that maybe has very powerful corporations, or and suddenly find itself sort of limited in a different way that feels familiar.
Well, that's certainly what the Danish government argues, right? From the Danish point of view, they're saying, oh, why not stick with the devil, you know? But I think in Greenland, the Greenlanders are tired of hearing that, you know, those warnings saying, oh, you can't trust the Americans, you can't trust the Chinese, you can't, you know, you can only trust us, us being Denmark. I don't think it's my place to say. Of course, there's a lot of speculation if whether China is taking advantage of Greenland. I don't think I'm in a position where I can really say whether that's a risk. I think it's something for sure. I think the Greenlanders will have to decide who they feel most comfortable working with. And as I understand it, the government wants to work, to collaborate broadly with different nations. And, you know, I think everyone agrees that Greenland has to collaborate with other countries to function. And whether that should be Denmark primarily, or whether it would be better to collaborate with the US or Canada or China. I don't really want to get involved in that question.
So what is the United States' role in this kind of troubled, uneasy relationship between Denmark and Greenland? Because, you know, they have had a military base on Greenland. The U.S. would have been one of the voices clamoring for decolonization in the post-war era. Yeah. However, I can imagine, this is purely speculative on my part, I can imagine the U.S. maybe turning a blind eye to Danish-Greenlandic relations because Greenland is strategically important, and they certainly, and Denmark was an ally after the war. You don't want to see the island drift toward Soviet influence or something like that, you know.
Correct.
So to what extent do you think that that Cold War dynamics played a part in enabling this relationship, this kind of dependency between Greenland and Denmark?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. If you look at a globe, you can really see how close the north of Greenland is to Moscow and the former Soviet Union. And for sure, it was an extremely important territory, especially in the Cold War, and of course now again. Mm-hmm. But these are the same years where Denmark became a member of NATO. And I think there's a consensus that the main Danish contribution to NATO for many years was Greenland, and the fact that Denmark let the United States have several air bases and naval bases there. So yeah, I think there was an interest from the U.S. to not push for Greenlandic independence, in that, you know, would the Soviet have gotten more influence? Interestingly enough, it was also the other way around. If you, the Danish negotiator had quite a good relationship with the Russian negotiator, because the Danish negotiator Hamal Lanung had been in Russia, had been married to the widower of a Russian or Soviet wife, and he spoke Russian, and he basically convinced the Russians to vote for Greenlandic inclusion into Denmark, because making the case that it was better for the Soviet Union that Denmark had control of the territory rather than an independent Greenland getting too influenced by the United States. So I think both superpowers have sort of were more comfortable with Denmark being the in charge in Greenland. Ironically, yeah.
So we've got this 1953 referendum. We've had this 1979 Home Rule Act and the 2009 Self-Government Act that's affected Greenland's sovereignty vis-a-vis Denmark. Have these acts had any material impact on the way that Denmark and Greenland view the other and themselves, or are these mostly pro forma acts, so to speak, that don't really affect the cultural and economic relationships underneath?
I think they've definitely had impact. And I think for the generation of politicians in Greenland that succeeded in gaining home rule in 79, that was seen as the end goal. And they were really happy with that situation. The ruling party for over 30 years was Siumut, which means a head. And the politicians in that party were quite progressive in the sense of making Greenlandic more European. Mm-hmm. So I think that generation of politicians really were quite content with home rule, saying, okay, we are in charge of our own local matters, but we're part of the Danish crown, and, you know, we want to be Danish. But in the decades after the Home Rule Act, there was within this Siumut party, there really was a revolution from the more traditional wing of the party, people who were still living in the smaller settlements, living from fishing and sealing, saying, you know, we don't want to be more Danish. We want to work to maintain a traditional way of life in Greenland. We don't want to just slowly drift towards Europe. And of course, the Danish membership of the EU, that was the turning point for Greenlanders demanding home rule. In the years after the Home Rule Act, there was a revolt inside the Siumut party to break further free of the Danish influence. And I think if you look at the younger generation today, there is an idea that the politicians who agreed to the Home Rule Act didn't finish the job. You know, they agreed to a measure of independence or self-determination that was not enough. And that's what the younger generation specifically is pushing for today. And of course, with the Self-Rule Act of 2009, that does give a lot of power to the Greenlanders themselves, because they can take political areas, they can say hjemtage in Danish. They can decide to, you know, take a political area and decide over that themselves at any point. And they can also decide to break free from Denmark at any point. But again, they have to have the economy to do that. Correct. Exactly. So the subsidy would end. So it's not, you know, you have to find a solution to that. And I think that's really what the vast majority of Greenlanders want. They want to find a way to be independent of the subsidy and thus of Denmark.
So in reading your book, it seems to me that the relationship between Greenland and Denmark is dysfunctional. So that's the way it feels to read this book, is that it's like this toxic family relationship where people just can't quit each other and just can't detach with love, so to speak. Do you see there's the historical legacy, the economic and cultural oppression, if you want to call it that. But on the other hand, every year, the Queen of Denmark sends a greeting on New Year's Eve to the people of Greenland. She goes on her yacht and pays a visit. You know, there's this warm, respectful relationship on the part of the royal family toward the Greenlandic people. There's like an uneasy relationship between Denmark and Greenland, and yet this warm embrace on the part of some Danish institutions toward the people and the land of Greenland. How do those realities coexist?
Well, the royal family is sort of a special case, because the Greenlanders are quite devoted to the royal family. But I will also say that the royal family seem to know much more about Greenland and be much more interested in the Greenlanders than your average Dane. So I think that's something that the Greenlanders respect very much, that there is this genuine concern. Because the fact is that, you know, a colleague of mine, Kirsten Tistel, has said, you know, the Danes have to come to terms with the fact that Greenland is not Danish. And that's kind of a sorrow for many Danes. And it's bizarre in some way, I think, because a lot of Danes don't know anything about Greenland. I didn't know much about Greenland before moving there. And still we have this idea that it belongs to us. And, you know, on the other hand, you have Greenlanders who are constantly taught about Denmark and how their relationship vis-a-vis Denmark is, because they're sort of the underdog in the relationship. So that makes a really unequal relationship. And then, you know, on top of that, I think the problem is that Danes are not very aware of our own colonial history in Greenland. So there's very little sensitivity to issues that are very, sensitive in Greenland.
I recall just from living in Denmark for many years that it's hard to get to Greenland. You would think it would be a cheap and easy flight, but it's not. It's expensive to travel there. Other cities are not connected to Greenland by major airport. Do you think that if it were easier for people to get to Greenland or easier for Danes to access Greenland, they might understand how different it is from, they might have a greater appreciation for the fact that it's just a different place as opposed to out of sight, but exists in the mind, in the political mind of Denmark, and is therefore susceptible to being manipulated by political narratives, so to speak.
Yeah, that might be, I mean, that might be a good point, you know, that I think most people change their view, most Danes, I should say, change their view of the Greenland when they've visited. And, you know, you get a reality check on your ideas of why don't they just do this or why don't they just do that. But on the other hand, unfortunately, I think there are also quite a lot of Danes who have spent time in Greenland, working in Greenland, who has a very... what can you say? Oppressive view of the Greenlanders. You know, you hear Danes that have worked in Greenland make claims about Greenlanders generally that are not very respectful. So, you know, it also for some has the opposite effect, unfortunately. There is very little cultural understanding. I think that, you know, one thing is going there, but you also have to, I think you have to have a historical and cultural understanding on top of, you know, the geographical understanding.
So my final question, what has the reception of your book been like in Denmark and in Greenland? Because Pelle Broberg, as I said in the intro, the foreign minister, Pelle Broberg was very animated on the topic of your book. And he felt that this was a bombshell. This is going to change everything. I mean, are people scandalized by the revelations in your book?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the book got a lot of attention here in Denmark as well when it was released in early June. And for sure, there was a lot of debate. Like, I think Danes generally, we have this perception that we're always the goody-two-shoe in the international community. And the fact that we were, acting like this was a shock to many. And but the ball is sort of in the Greenlandic court, if you will, because, you know, parties from both sides of the political aisle here supported what happened back then. So it's a bit difficult, I think, for politicians here to react to it, especially since most of the parliament actually support or want to keep Greenland as part of Denmark. So it's still a difficult topic here. But yeah, it was a shock to many. And I think it's kind of a hard look in the mirror for a lot of Danes to read this. And I'm still, you know, every day I get messages from readers who are happy to finally get another side of the story, because as I said to you earlier, the narrative here in Denmark has really been we were an altruistic colonial power who, you know, helped Greenlanders selflessly. And I think people are it's refreshing to get the other side of the story.
Yeah, it's always. We're not, and Denmark is not, you know, Denmark is not alone in having to confront the other side of the story. You know, it's happening
absolutely
a lot of places. So for readers who, if you can read Danish, I definitely recommend checking out your parents' burn. I'm a slow reader of Danish, so but I read it and was riveted. So hopefully Imperiets Burn or Children of the Empire will be available in English very soon. So hopefully there'll be an international clamor for the English edition. Otherwise, readers can check it out in Danish. Anna Kristina Hermann, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much.
That's it from the podcast today. But did you know Polar Futures has a newsletter? For a deeper dive into what's happening in extreme latitudes, subscribe at investableuniverse.com/polarfutures. I'm Rebecca Darst. We'll be back with more Polar Futures next time.